What makes successful people successful? What makes them stand out over other people? Why do they succeed when others don't? Is it simply talent, money, parents, mere chance, hard work? Gladwell concludes that the great aren't so great. Rather, it's the right mix of opportunities they've been given outside of their control and the effort they put into taking the advantage of those opportunities. He de-emphasizes the belief that some people are prodigies or so talented that they are going to succeed no matter what. Gladwell explains what he calls the law of 10,000 hours. It takes 10,000 hours to master virtually anything, but it's 10,000 of hours of work devoted specifically to one task. He gives examples like famous musicians, all-star athletes, computer programmers, Mozart himself, airline pilots, and others. I think one of his most striking examples to me is Bill Gates. And while most of us assume that Gates was simply a super genius destined to succeed no matter what, Gladwell provides some insight that we most likely may have never considered. For instance, think of his history. You probably don't know about these things. Bill Gates was the son of wealthy parents. He grew up in the Seattle area. He went to an exclusive private school in junior high. This school had the money for a computer club and purchased computers that were state-of-the-art. Now, this was in the late 60s when almost no colleges even had computers like the one his school got. He started programming in eighth grade, and he lived in the computer department. The University of Washington just happened to be within walking distance for him, and it just so happened they started a computer programming department the very next year. It just so happened that a boy a grade older than him was in his computer club, and his mother taught at that computer lab. And she asked that this computer club come and test the programs that the University of Washington students were writing. So Gates would program for hours, late after school, into the evenings. He was obsessed with programming. He was getting 20 to 30 hours a week at age 15. He would sneak out in the middle of the night, walk to the University of Washington, and program for more time during the middle of the night, from 3 a.m. to 6 p.m. when the lab was open. He was obsessed with it. As a senior, his teacher allowed him to start a full-time job while still in school, considering it part of a study program, and he went to work and met his mentor, who greatly advanced his understanding even farther than what he knew. By the time he dropped out of Harvard his sophomore year, he had already been programming over 7 years and was already way past 10,000 hours. Now, while obviously brilliant, Bill Gates could not be Bill Gates without the incredible lucky breaks that he simply took advantage of. Could he? Do circumstances like these just present themselves to the fortunate, or is something more going on? Perhaps you might wonder, what is God up to in my life? I don't see work like that. I don't see necessarily circumstances being orchestrated for my good, for my benefit. It doesn't seem to point to a God who is in absolute control. My life isn't really working the way I expected it to. Is he still present? Is he still active? Now, Gladwell himself gives no thought or attention to who is arranging each of these coincidences. But he's unwittingly giving a strong argument for what we recognize as God's providence, his arrangement and control of even the smallest details of our lives. Every detail comes under his plan, under his purpose. We're going to look at the book of Esther this evening and see how God arranges all of our lives' events for his purposes, for his glory. We'll see how intricately God is faithfully providing and protecting his people in even the most seemingly insignificant and mundane actions. Let's turn to the book of Esther. And what we're going to do this evening is skip through several different chapters. We'll dip in at several different places. And I know usually that's not a great thing to do, is have people turn in their Bibles. It's easy to lose you. But please stick with me. I think there's some details. There's some things that we'll see here tonight that will help us as we look at what God is seeking to accomplish through the life of Esther and show us about himself. This story is a great story. It's a rags-to-riches story. We have the story of a young girl, an orphan girl, a Jewish girl, that rises from obscurity, becomes the queen of the greatest empire in the world. The Persian Empire was the dominant power in her day. It stretched from India to Ethiopia in the south. It stretched all the way past Israel into the south of France. This was a huge, huge empire. And the plot features everything we love in a great story. Features a beautiful and courageous heroine, an evil villain and his diabolical plans, suspense, unexpected reversals of fortune, comic irony, and a happy ending. But the question that the book is posing is, who is the hero? Who's the hero? Do all these circumstantial, everyday events work out by mere coincidence or chance? What is God up to? Now, biblically, the events of Esther take place actually near the end of the Old Testament, even though it's placed in your Bible somewhat near the middle. Esther occurs during the time of Israel's captivity. Israel's taken away by Babylon into captivity. They're there for 70 years. Babylon is overtaken by the Persian Empire, Cyrus. And they will later, the Persians, be taken over by Alexander the Great. But we're here in the middle of the Persian Empire. The events of the book of Esther occur probably somewhere between Ezra's return to rebuild the temple and Nehemiah's return to rebuild Jerusalem. The setting for the drama is the Persian capital, Susa. We're going to see, as we look through the book, God's providence. We're going to get an overview of the story, and we'll see how God's providence works throughout the book, and then we'll look at God's preservation and conclude with five lessons of application. The theme of Esther centers on divine providence. Specifically, God providentially protects his people. So let's define what providence means. It's a theological term for the teaching that God continuously and actively preserves and maintains the existence of his creation according to his pleasure. He governs all events, including the free acts of men and their external circumstances, and directs everything to his appointed end for his glory. If we break it down, there's two parts. We see the vid or video. We get our word video to see, and pro means to come before. It's God sees beforehand and acts accordingly. Thus, the primary thrust is on God's behind-the-scenes work in governing human affairs. Now, as we do an overview, a book overview like this, one of the questions that we need to ask is, why is this book in my Bible? Why do I need to pay attention to this? What is God trying to teach me? There's two things that stand out, I think. Number one is, it teaches us the history of a Jewish feast called Purim. Now, this isn't something we're going to spend a lot of time on, but it's something that I think plays into the story. We'll talk about that later. Secondly, it teaches us to observe, to pay attention, to recognize God's fingerprints in the ordinary, everyday events of our lives. It teaches us to look and see who he is and what he's doing. What's interesting about the book of Esther is that the author never one time mentions the name of God. Not once. Prayers never even mentioned. And it's intentional, I believe. Because in the silence, God is magnified. Because as we look at these events, we can only conclude that God could have done these things. There are no grand miracles in the book except the continual, ever-present hand of God directing the movements, thoughts, and actions of the characters on stage. God is controlling each and every event. The author, by the Spirit's divine guidance, tells us to look for the signs of God's work. Now, I know most of you probably know this story, know this account, but I want you to imagine with me reading this as a first-time reader. Let's take away all the things that we may know or think we know about the story and pay attention and look at some of the details this evening as we study this book. We're going to see several things that may look like chance references. Go with me to chapter 1. We'll introduce the book in verses 1 through 4. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. So we start with a very powerful king giving a feast that lasted 6 months. This king is powerful. I think we can assume that he's consumed with himself. We'll see feasting. If you read this book on your own, you'll see that feasting is a major part of this book. It's a theme. But the curtain opens on the stage and we meet the king, King Ahasuerus. Right after this feast, we haven't read this and we won't take the time to look at it, but he puts on another week-long feast, and that brings us to the story of his wife Vashti. He calls Vashti out and he says, "Come appear before us." And while we don't know why, she says, "No." She says, "I'm not coming." We have no interaction or understanding from the narrator whether this was a right decision or a wrong decision. All we know is she says, "I'm not coming." And the king deposes her for her rebellion. And then we see at the beginning of chapter 2, he later regrets this. Next, we meet a man, one of the heroes of the story, named Mordecai. Look down at chapter 2, verses 5 and 6. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah. Now, we're told several things about Mordecai that we need to make note of. He is a Jew of the house of Benjamin. This is important. This wasn't mentioned by mistake. I'll tie this in a minute. He is a guardian, we find out in the rest of the chapter, of a woman named Esther. Esther was orphaned, and Mordecai is her cousin. He takes her into his home, and he becomes her guardian. Now, since Vashti has been deposed, the king is looking for a new queen. The king gets moved by his officials to set up this giant contest, invite all the beautiful women in the land, and Esther, for some reason, becomes one of those people that come into the king's harem. Look at chapter 2, verses 15, and then we'll look at verse 17. Look down at verse 15, and we'll look at the last part of the verse. Now, Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So let's pause for a moment and look at these events for a second. Who causes Esther to have favor in the eyes of the king? I mean, think about it. This man is seeing hundreds, probably hundreds, if not thousands of women paraded before him, and God says, "This one. This one." What's strange about this is a Persian king, and he sets his favor on a Jewish girl, and somehow they don't care to find out what her nationality is. Is that a coincidence? Or just mere chance? Is her beauty a coincidence? Or is God even ruling in the way that she looks? Who causes her to capture his attention? What caused Vashti to refuse her husband? I don't think she was probably surprised that her husband was this kind of man that he would ask her to do something like this. She obviously knew that something would happen if she refused him, yet she refuses anyway. Was it simply mere chance that the king hastily removes his wife Vashti? Look down with me now at verse 21 of chapter 2. Here we see Mordecai. We're told of an incident in verse 21 where he discovers this assassination plot. In verse 21, it says, "In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." Again, it just so happens that he overhears this plot. It just so happens that the person that overhears this plot is related to the queen. What are we to make of the events where he's given no reward? Where it's taken into the Chronicles and we move right along. chapter 3, in verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. Now, this story takes place over 10 years. And while we don't know it, this has already been about 3 years of time in the story. Where has Haman been? How does he come from nowhere and become the second most powerful man in the land? He's now the prime minister. Where does he come from? Why now? And to the point we mentioned about Mordecai's heritage, did you notice who Haman is? He's Haman the Agagite. Now, what that means is he's from the tribe of Amalek, Israel's sworn enemy. When they left Egypt, they're heading out, crossing the Red Sea, and the first group of people that attack them are the Amalekites. And we have a story in our Bible from the Kings when Saul is told, "You kill King Agag." Now, King Saul, he's of the line of which tribe? Benjamin. His father's name is Kish. Do you think it's just a coincidence that these two families are at odds again? Why does God record the nationality of this man? I think he wants us to see that he's doing something beyond what we would expect, beyond what we would just look at normally. So, verse 2, we see now the plot is starting to develop. Verse 2 of chapter 3, "And all the king's servants were at the king's gate, bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage." Now, Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman. And we need to be careful about how we apply this, okay? Because there are a lot of times where we might say, well, he's making a good spiritual decision, but we're not really given that information. And in fact, it looks like really he's just making a foolish decision here. Because this isn't a call from the king to worship Haman as some spiritual deity. This is simply a call to honor him as a court official. And for some reason, whether it's simple pride or stubbornness, Mordecai just says, "No, I'm not going to worship him." And he lets it be known he's a Jew. Why does he do that? He told Esther to hide her nationality, but he tells them and publicly refuses to bow to this man. What we're seeing here is these main characters are flawed heroes, aren't they? Mordecai was not thinking the right way about this, perhaps. He says, "I'm not going to bow to this man." Perhaps it's this old family battle or issue between the two nations. He says to Esther, "You go into this contest where you become part of the king's harem." Now, the Bible isn't really interested in talking a whole lot about what this was, but I think we are missing it if we think that everything was pure and upright about this. In order to be chosen by the king, she had to go sleep with him, and he would choose her to be his queen. Otherwise, she would go into the royal harem and never come to him again unless he called her. There are flaws in these characters. I mean, think about this compared with Daniel and his friends, where they say, "No, I'm not taking part of this secular practice." What is God doing by including some of their flaws? The divine narrator wants us to be looking beyond the main characters for a greater hero. Something more is going on. Mordecai's refusal to bow enrages Haman. And Haman begins to set up this plot. He's angry. He's upset with more than just Mordecai. And he sets up this plan to destroy all of the Jewish people. I want you to understand, this is a huge nation. This would include all the Jews that are with Ezra, later with Nehemiah. All of them would be wiped out. Virtually all of the Jewish people would be annihilated. Mordecai cries and fasts in chapter 4. And we come to one of the more familiar passages or verses in chapter 4. Verse 14. Look with me at verse 14. "And after Esther learns of the plans, Mordecai tells her all the things that are going on. He says to Esther, 'For if you will keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?'" And I want you to see two very important things about Mordecai's advice. Number one, God's sovereign providence must never produce passivity. Mordecai does not say to her, listen, God will raise someone up to deliver his people. Don't worry about it, Esther. Don't do anything. Just sit and wait. He says, no, perhaps you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. You have responsibility here. Take action. The second thing is God desires to use human agents to accomplish his purposes. What has God placed in your life? What opportunities are there for you to take advantage of? Moving into the plot, farther, Esther puts her life on the line, comes before the king, and he invites the king and Haman into a private feast. Now, before that, there's this interlude where we see Haman again being upset by Mordecai. Look down at chapter 5, verse 14. Chapter 5, verse 14. And his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows, and this could be a stake or a pike, 50 cubits high, be made, and in the morning, tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. So he builds this extensive gallows. This is to be a public execution. This is to be someone pouring out their wrath and saying, I am putting him under my thumb and crushing him like a bug. He has the authority to do this, and it's about to happen. And yet we come to the pivot point of the story. Chapter 6, verse 1. On that night. Now let's stop for just a second. In verse 14, he says the friends and his wife are saying, in the morning, the very next day, Mordecai is dead. He's as good as dead. The second most powerful man in the world wants him dead. He's dead tomorrow. 6:1 says, on that night, the king could not sleep. And he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. Is that a coincidence? That's shocking. At just the right moment. And think through these verses as we know the story. He happens to go get the Chronicles, and he just happens to read about Mordecai and his attempts to save the king from the assassination and how he rescued him from death. And he says to Haman, what has been done for this man? Nothing. So go reward him. Now, here's what's interesting about this. Think about this. All of a sudden, Haman shows up with his plan. Does that seem strange? The king's already gone to bed. Does Haman not know his king's bedtime? Why is he there? Could Esther have done this? Okay. Could Esther have come into his bedchambers or the outer room of his bedchambers and said, I have something to talk to you about? She couldn't come unless she was summoned. God is using exactly the right person to reverse these events. And Haman, in his narcissistic tendencies, believes that the only person that the king would want to honor is him. So he thinks up the best thing he can think for honor, for something to be done to him. And God says, in a comic twist of irony, you go do that to your enemy. Put Mordecai on that horse and lead him through the town in the king's royal robe, saying, thus shall it be done to the man in whom the king delights to honor. Haman is absolutely mortified, absolutely humiliated. But nobody but him really knows. Only he is mortified. And yet with his own pride and his self-love, he says to his wife, in verse 13, he told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. His wife is predicting his doom. Even his wife knows that something more is going on behind the scenes. This is more than just coincidence to her. And he predicts his destruction, rather. In chapter 7, we finally come to the end of the story as Haman reveals, or rather Esther reveals Haman's plot. And the strange thing that happens there as Esther reveals to the king after the second feast, the king is angry and he's not sure what to do. This is his prime minister. This is his queen. Who's he going to choose? And he comes back into the room and mistakenly assumes that Haman is sexually assaulting his wife in front of him. God is turning Haman's plot on its head. And his vengeance is going to be poured out on himself. Haman's servants enter the room just at that moment and say, well, we have this gallows for the guy that just saved your life, or you just read about saving your life. Why would you kill him? Chapter 8, Esther and Mordecai devise a way to counteract this law that the Jews were going to be destroyed. And think about it. We even have a saying, the law of the Medes and Persians, something that cannot be revoked. That law could not be counteracted. Yet they found a way to make a similar law that allows the Jews to arm themselves and defend themselves. And there's a great victory. And in chapter 9 and 10, we see the whole situation turned upside down as Mordecai receives a position of honor and influence. And now I want to talk about, before we get into our second part of the sermon, talk about what this Feast of Purim is. This Jewish holiday is celebrated on a single day in February or March. Really, it's very much similar to our Christmas. Presents are given. There's pageants. There's the reading of the Book of Esther. And families give to one another and to the poor. It's a lively, joyous day of celebration preceded by a day of fasting. But how did it get its name? How did it get its name? Well, if you look back in the story, in verse number 7 of chapter 3, Haman decides the date of execution based on casting something called Pur, or lots, or something similar to what we would say are dice. He rolls the dice, and by the end of the story, that roll of the dice, that symbol of chance, how do you control dice? That turns into a celebration of God's protection. And it's an irony. Even the name of the festival is an irony. Saying God protects us even when it looks like things are the darkest, even when it looks like chance has taken over. It's not by chance. I want you to see then, as we review a couple of these things, just the way some of the things just switch themselves, the reversals. God's most striking works involve his ability to utterly and instantly reverse seemingly hopeless situations, especially when his people are threatened. Think about the literary ironies that abound in the Book of Esther, and I'm only going to highlight a few. Haman hates Mordecai. Later, God makes him honor Mordecai. Haman decrees this death, and he publishes it. It cannot be reversed. Mordecai publishes a decree. The decree is against the Jews. Next, the decree is against the Jews' enemy, and great victory is won. The Jews mourn in the middle of the book, and at the end, they're rejoicing. Haman is rejoicing and boasting in his great favor with the king. And by the time he's done, before he's put to death on his own gallows, he's mourning and fearing. Zeresh, his wife, is advising, okay, kill him this spectacularly public way. And by the end, she's saying, he's going to be the death of you. Haman makes a gallows for Mordecai, and he ends up getting hanged on that gallows. Is there any question as to who's behind this story? There's one more reversal that I want you to think about. Even the way the story as a whole is structured reveals an ingenious and intentional emphasis on this reversal. Okay, and here's what I mean. Chapter 10 mirrors chapter 1. Chapters 8 and 9 mirror chapters 2 and 3, and so on. Until we get to the very pivot of the story that we looked at in chapter 6, verse 1. On that night, the king could not sleep. One commentator said, by making the pivot point of the reversal an insignificant event rather than the point of highest dramatic tension, the author is taking the focus away from human action. This reinforces the message that no one in the story, not even the most powerful person in the empire, is in control of what is about to happen. An unseen power is controlling the reversal of destiny. This isn't Esther or Mordecai or Haman or the most powerful ruler in the land. This must be someone else. This must be someone else. Our second point is the preservation of God. And we'll move through this very quickly. God is not only preserving here Esther, Mordecai, and the Jews, but I want you to think about it. This story is important to your spiritual history as well as mine. Because something bigger is at stake here. You see, God's plan of redemption is on the line. Satan, God's enemy, has devised a way to wipe out the seed of the woman. His attack is nothing less than the entire gospel. The gospel is at stake. If Haman killed all of the Jewish people, there would be no Messiah. There would be no Christianity. There would be no church. But God's purposes can never, ever be thwarted. Never. We ought to rest in God's ability to accomplish His plans, to fulfill His purposes in spite of all opposition. And I want you to see how far this goes. God's plans are never even threatened. Even when things look the darkest, God is not uneasy. He's not unsure of what to do. He's not simply smarter than his opponent or just skilled at reacting to Satan's strategies and just making the right counter move at the right time. He's never out of control, never frustrated or anxious. He never feels stressed or wonders what might happen if this comes about. All of the enemy's schemes are used to unwittingly forward God's purposes. You see, it's not even a fair fight. It's not as if they're even equal enemies. Satan makes these plans and God says, I will use those for my glory and my purposes. It's never threatened. Psalm 2, verse 1 and 2, it says, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed. The Lord who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. He's nothing like us. When He makes plans, there's no question that they'll come to fruition. There's no question that they'll happen. He works out even the sleepless night of a king to His own ends, for His own glory. Let's look in conclusion at five lessons on silent providence. Lesson number one, just because God is silent doesn't mean He's absent. Just because God is silent doesn't mean He's not there. I mean, think about the Bible as a whole. Usually we're hoping for God to dramatically break into our lives and do something that we can't escape. But how many times did God really do that throughout all of Bible history? There were really three main times when miracles were occurring. And other than that, God works by this means, by silent providence, where it only seems as though God is silent. Think of the many passive verbs throughout the book that imply God's actions. Chapter 9, verse 22, it says, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them, from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday. Who gives the Jews relief and turns their sorrow into joy? Who turns this situation upside down? We can't say Esther. We can't say Mordecai. We can't even say the king who makes decrees. It must be someone else. Secondly, human responsibility is highlighted in God's silence. Realize that God is in absolute control of who you are and where you are. It is not an accident. It's for a very specific reason. You may not know it, but it is for a reason. God-given opportunities bring God-intended responsibilities. You do not have opportunities for influence by accident. How are you using them, mom and dad? Leader in the church, church member, neighbor, how are you using your opportunities? What's interesting in this book is we don't get the sense that God is forcing people into doing things they don't want to do. God's not a robot maker, but he's so powerful that he uses the actions and choices of free human agents to accomplish his will. Number three, nothing. Not one event, not even the roll of the dice, can be attributed to chance. So why has God placed you in the job you're in? Why the boss that's your boss? Why did God give you children that struggle so much, perhaps? Why do you have neighbors, the neighbors that you have? Why are you a part of this particular body? God-given opportunities bring God-intended responsibilities. What part does God want you to play in the lives of those around you? Proverbs 16:9 says, "The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his step." Number four, God controls and directs even the free acts of evil men for his own praise and purposes. And Psalm 76 tells us, "Surely the wrath of man shall praise thee." Now, this might be hard for us a little bit because it seems like, wow, is God using sin or allowing people to sin and just using that? Is that okay? I want you to think of this in this way. If it bothers you that sin, God can use sin without condoning it, look at the cross. Look at the cross. Who really put Jesus on that cross? Isaiah 53:10 tells us that it pleased the Father to crush him. That was his plan. Not evil Jews, not the chief priests. Not even sin or Satan himself is outside of God's control or purposes. What's interesting as we look at wrath, the whole story always turns on this idea of wrath. Think about it. The wrath of the king against Vashti makes way for Esther to come into the kingdom. The wrath of these two assassins against the king makes way for Mordecai to be noticed and exalted. The wrath of Haman against Mordecai presents this whole crisis. The wrath of the king against Haman finishes and resolves our story. John Piper says in Desiring God, "People lift their hand to rebel against the Most High, only to find that their rebellion is unwitting service in the wonderful designs of God. The hardened obedience of men's hearts leads not to frustration of God's plans, but to their fruition." That should give us confidence. God's providence is powerful. It's so powerful that it brings good out of evil, making bad men and fallen angels to serve God's designs while they intend no such thing, giving the greatest efficiency to causes apparently the most contemptible, and infallibly securing the very best ends. All conspiracies against providence are vain. They're vain. And our last slide, our last thought, it encourages us to worship. It encourages us to worship. It gives us confidence in who He is, His power, His control, the fact that everything happening in your life is not an accident. That fender bender or car wreck that you can't explain is not an accident. The job that you don't have or don't like is not an accident. The family that you have, this body that you're in, it's not by chance. God intends for you to do something with it. And we could add, why are successful Christians perhaps successful? Because they're recognizing God's work. The sovereign God of the universe is very much the central character in this drama. And the inspired author wants us to be crystal clear as to who the hero is. And I love this passage in Isaiah 46. It says, "Remember this and stand firm, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose." Our worship ought to include then our faithfulness to serve as well. Our faithfulness to serve. What can God do with you in the opportunities that He's given? What does God want to do in your life? Who knows what he can accomplish in your home, Mom, as you're faithful? Who knows what he can accomplish with your witness? Who knows what he can accomplish in this body if we set our hearts to pursue and submit ourselves to those purposes of God? So our question is, what is God up to in your life? Let me close with this final illustration. Michelangelo spent 4 years creating what has become, what has come to be universally regarded as one of the greatest masterpieces in all of history, the Sistine Chapel. Since that time, though, the ceiling has been increasingly in danger of being lost forever, slowly eaten away by centuries of grime, soot, and other pollutants, as well as botched attempts at preserving it. Finally, a team of specialists spent the entire decade of the 1980s restoring the chapel ceiling. They worked systematically in minute proximity to the frescoed ceiling. And the restorers became so familiar over time with the intricate details of the work that they soon learned to recognize the master's own brushstrokes, just as if it were his handwriting. In the same way, careful attention to the delicate details of this biblical narrative, of your narrative, revealed the divine brushstrokes of the master of this universe. Can you recognize his handiwork in your life? If you cannot, or if you are having trouble recognizing it, perhaps you need to get to know the master a little better. Esther's a great place to start.